Hi, everybody. I am thrilled that you can join us today and welcome to all the good dog breeders that have just joined A to Z. And of course, welcome to all the longtime Platinum members. Always good to see your faces. Okay, so I'm going to start with Marilyn's question. She emailed it in to me, and I'm kind of dying to know what's going on. So Marilyn, do you want to give us a summary or you want me to read your question?
I can summarize. So Misty, it's for me, it's the saga of the thermometers.
Oh, yeah. So it's a good saga to talk about, that there is an inaccuracy in many digital thermometers, and that inaccuracy for us as breeders is, it's really important that we have accurate thermometers. So go ahead. You have a thermometer that's off.
I think so. I probably have three or four of them. And lo and behold, I picked up the one that may or may not have gotten calibrated or checked when I checked them last time. That said, yesterday Misty dropped down to 99.2 and then back to 99.4 for two readings, and then overnight up to 100.6. This morning, she was 101.6 and then 100.6. And at 1 p.m., she's back down to 99.4 again.
And what day is she on from ovulation?
She is on, 56?
56 from ovulation?
No, diestrus. I'm sorry. Diestrus.
56 from diestrus. So
she's actually, whelping window starts technically the 28th. Do I have my date?
You have your dates right? Wrong. No.
Okay.
Yeah. So if she's 56 days, so the whelping window for diestrus is 56 to 58. So you want to, I'll talk about it and then you can check your calendar and come back on. How's that? So. Okay. We have a number of ways to tell the whelping window, and I'm sort of talking to everyone here, Marilyn, because I know you know this. So we can narrow a whelping window beyond a breeding by certain events that happen during a heat cycle. So there's the LH surge, there's ovulation, and then there is diestrus. Those really are the three dates that enable us to establish when our puppies should safely be born. The most accurate of those is what's known as diestrus, which is the last day of the heat cycle. Can still be a fertile day, so you want to be cautious if you know that she's in diestrus. But there is this immediate transition from estrus when she's fertile to a non-fertile period. And the first day of that transition is the day one of diestrus. And we can only tell that by vaginal cytology. It's the only way to determine diestrus, which is why a lot of us do vaginal cytology, because it makes it so much safer. So, and the safety involved is that puppies need to be born by the last day of the whelping window, because their placentas deteriorate very rapidly. And that's how we get a lot of stillborn puppies, because they weren't born in time and their placentas just dissolved and went away. So Marilyn's going to confirm, but what she's saying is this slowly dropping gradual temperature drop as Misty is preparing to whelp. And so from my experience, the temperature of a bitch who is going to show us a temperature drop always drops below 99. So even 99.2, 99.4 don't count as temp drops. It has to be 98.8 or something along those lines. And that's why the calibration of those thermometers is so critical. Because even if it's 0.2 off, that can be really problematic for us. Are we looking at a 98.8 or are we looking at a 99? So I think that what you're seeing, Marilyn, is a gradual drop in progesterone, but it isn't that plummet. You know, so some girls will do the slow nosedive of progesterone, and some of them will just 12 hours, boom, their progesterone drops, and they have that big temperature drop. Gosh, some of them at the 96 level. So once, and you know this, but I'll just say it anyway, once you see that temp drop, we want to see puppies within 48 hours of that temp drop, ideally 36, because her progesterone's down, the corpus lutea are dissolving. Those are on the ovaries. That's what keeps the placentas healthy, and they deteriorate, and they deteriorate pretty rapidly. So I don't think you've seen the temp drop, Marilyn, but you're right. We need to know that whelping window plus the temp drop to be sure what we're looking at. And we know only 80% of bitches have a temp drop. So the whelping window dominates. Whatever you have set as your whelping window based on diastrus, that's the most important thing. If we also have the temp drop coinciding with that, then that gives us additional information and gives us an idea of when she's probably in an early stage one, but you know, stage one could go on forever. And so likely I should say it's not imminent that she's gonna whelp, and she'll probably have her puppies while we're on the call. But anyway, so did you have a chance to check the calendar while I was blah, blah, blah?
Yes. So diastrus was July 3rd. So she is actually only maybe about 52, 53 days past diastrus.
So she's doing this slow drop in progesterone, which is perfectly normal. It's perfectly normal. And so progesterone it stimulates their body temperature. And so the rest of the systems in the body that keep the body at, you know, 101 begin to shut down because progesterone is keeping it elevated. And then when the progesterone goes away, the body now has to catch up. And that's where we see the temperature drop, is the other systems lagging a little, this progesterone drop. So what you're seeing in her is this sort of gradual drop. You still have not hit the temp drop yet. So I think that's fine. It's good. Just use your temperature chart. And if it's above that line, you know, the 99 line, you're good to go.
Not yet. Okay.
Not yet. Not yet.
Just after the last cycle, and you know, this is her last one, and I'm just, you know, on pins and needles. Because it's really big litter for her.
Yeah, she has six, is that right?
Six or seven.
And Misty had a pyometra on her last season, and Marilyn was able to treat it. But obviously that means that she had to be bred on this season, and now there's always concern. I mean, we always go into a whelping a little bit on the concern side. If you have a Doppler or can use the ultrasound at work, you can check heart rates and just make sure everybody's fine. But I think you have days.
Yeah, my Doppler, I did it yesterday, and all the heart rates sound really good, and they're good rates, which is where I think maybe I'm fairly positive I have seven.
Yay!
Which is shocking.
It's amazing. It's amazing. It's very exciting. Good. Okay. Breathe. Have some wine.
You're good. Thank you.
Bye. Okay. I'm going to jump to Cheryl, who is patiently. Oh. Did I lose you, Cheryl?
No, I just had to unmute.
Oh, there you are. Hey.
Okay. So I have done Embark on my litter of puppies for the first time.
Yep.
And I just had some questions. I'm wondering if people can tell me how accurate the weight prediction is. I have a huge variation. Well, for a small breed, it's a huge variation. For a female, anywhere from 27 to 22 pounds. 27 would likely be oversized.
That's what Embark is saying.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm happy to have people chime in. I'll tell you my experience is that it has been, so for the Goldens, it's been probably plus or minus 5 pounds.
Which okay.
is, you know, that's like 10%, pretty big variation. I can look up Nick's and see. So Barbara Hoops, I don't know if she's on. I think she's on vacation, so she may not be on. Her claim on her toy poodles is that it's not accurate. That the smaller the dog, the less accurate it is. Uh-huh. So that's what she's found. Does anybody else feel free to chime in if you've used Embark and just gotten an idea of?
I'm trying to, you know, I got 4 females from this litter and I want to keep a puppy. And that would be, you know, if this one girl that I, the one I really like, of course, is the 27 pound one.
Of course.
I've never had a girl weigh more than 23. I do know they could be up to about 25 and probably still, you know, we have a height disqualification. So that's my big worry. So that's fairly important. And then the other thing I wanted to ask about that is, so under coat traits, on some of my puppies, it says likely furnished, I'm reading off the computer, mustache, beard, and or eyebrows. Now, that's bizarre on a Quaker.
So that's really interesting. So I just pulled Nick's up. So I am raising a Quaker for those of you who just don't know me, but I've been raising this puppy and I'll have him a few more months, my first Quaker. And so he's a male. He also is likely furnished according to Embark, and his weight is, his adult weight is 24 pounds and he's already at 28 pounds. And I think he's gonna top out at 30 for his weight. So I would not hang a lot on the weight.
Okay.
For the girls. And then I have no idea on the furnishing. You know, when they do these coat traits, they're not able to use rare breeds and see how the genetics may play out in rare breeds. So my guess is that it's kind of irrelevant, that there's something else in the Quaker's genetics that is making it so that they're not going to have eyebrow furnishings and things like that.
Okay. So also they, you know, it's like some of them say likely light shedders, some say lightly heavy shedders. I just find that really interesting. Some say curly coats, some say straight coats. And so I don't know what to make of all this.
Interesting. Pay a lot of attention to the traits. I would focus on the health.
Okay. Well, health they issues. Don't breed specific anything for Quakers on there.
No, but you can still do. Are they carriers for anything? Are any of them carriers for anything?
The only thing they have is this invertible disc. Let me see. I'm trying to think what it's. It is.
IBD.
Every Quaker alive that's been tested has at least one allele. Many have two, and we don't tend to have problems. So I don't know if that, it's something to care about or not, or, you know.
Well, if it's throughout the breed, obviously it's not going to be a discriminating factor for choosing puppies. I think that Good Dogs having Dr. Casey Carl back from Paw Prints next week, I think, maybe this week, to talk specifically about disc disease. He's already done one talk on it, and that might be a really good thing to try and attend and ask him what it means in breeds where we aren't seeing IBDD, but they are carriers or even affected, you know, affected. They have two genes, not really affected, but they.
Puppy that has two genes and then the rest all have one.
And so in some breeds, those genes express themselves. In other breeds, they don't. And in Quakers, it may be a don't. So an example is the Merle genes in Korean shepherds. they have no negative consequences related to the Merle genes compared to all other breeds or most other breeds where there are negative consequences of double Merles. So, you know, we're still learning so much about canine genetics, and the trait information really is in many breeds, experimental, especially the rare breeds, simply because we aren't able to get enough of a population to study rare breeds. The health, I think, is more important, but there are breeds. I was just going through some IBDD information the other day, and there's a breed where everybody has it and nobody's fazed by it. Oh, it's Pembroke's.
Cockers and beagles, they say they all have it.
Yeah. So I think Dr. Carl would be a great person to ask that question of, just because he is a geneticist. Casey, C-A-S-E-Y, Carl, C-A-R-L. He's at Paw Prince Genetics, and he's spoken a couple times on IVDD. And I think it is a gene we all need to be cognizant of, but whether it affects our breed or not.
Then they also talk about diversity on the DLA diversity. Okay. And so, but they don't give you numbers. And in Quakers, there was a Finnish study, and I have all the information. There's like 8 combinations that they find in Quakers, some of which are really rare and others are not rare at all. And I've sent them an email and a call trying to see if I can get those numbers, because for the population, it would be great to keep one that's very rare. But for the individual dog, I assume having high diversity is what's more important, you know, for...
As far as we know, so.
Right, I realize that's just a correlation, not a proven fact, right?
Yeah, we're still making progress. So this is the genetic coefficient of inbreeding as opposed to the statistical coefficient of inbreeding that we've used for the last, since the 40s, long, long time. And now Embark and at a minimum UC Davis are doing these genetic diversity based on your dog's genetics. I'm a little more familiar with how to use University of California Davis. I have my dogs in Embark, but I can't figure out how to use that to select breeding stock.
And that's what I was hoping get from this.
Yeah, but I think calling or asking them is a great idea. I think that's really important, because if they can tell you what DLAs each of your puppies has, then you can compare it to the breed.
Right.
We're only looking at a couple genes when we look at DLAs, so it's usually pretty easy to take a look at them and get a feel for it. But I've got to tell you, I haven't dug into Embark. I know that Dr. Stella and Nate just did a talk with Embark this week. I went to listen to it at lunchtime today and got caught up in something else, so I haven't had a chance to listen to it, but I think it was either late last week or earlier this week. So that might be worth listening to on Good Dog.
Okay.
Good Breeder Center.
One more thing I'm going to tell you real quick. If you have done the Embark on your dog, they are collecting that information for us. You know that for the study in the Netherlands.
So yes.
Which you haven't already shared it.
Yeah, you know, I did collect it on Nick. I have to go in and see if I shared it. That's a good point. I'll go check.
Or form that you'll need to get to be able to release the information to the people doing the research. So
thank you. I'll look at that. That's a good reminder. Okay.
All right.
Well, I pretty much provided no answers for you, Cheryl, but there you go. Good luck.
All right.
I will say, Cheryl, it does look like they're surviving their outdoor adventures. So it must have either cooled off or you found a time of day where they...
Enough. Oh, let me just say one thing I did that was horrible the day before yesterday. I took them outside in the middle of the afternoon just to pee real quick. They went out and walked on my gravel pin and started screaming and picking their little feet up. And I could only grab three and run and then put them in the pool and grab. It was awful. So we can only go out first thing in the morning and after seven at night because I don't have shade over the gravel and they do not to get in it.
poor little guys. Okay, lesson learned on that one.
All right.
I'm going to pop to Darla. I saw you put a question in. I'm going to lower your hand. Can you unmute?
Yes. Just really quickly, this is my second litter. And I have Goldens, and my first litter, I was not feeding raw, but I am really seeing the benefits of raw with my Goldens, and I don't really want to switch from that. And so my question is, I've been reading through the section on the resources that talk about Goldens, my goodness, about feeding raw.
There's probably a lot on Goldens in there too, just saying.
Yeah.
I have a little affinity for them.
So sorry. No. I just want to make sure that I am doing the right things with her. When I talked with my vet, I really had to explain the raw that I was feeding her. It's a balance through My Pet Carnivore. They balance the organs, the meat, and the bones. And so adding that carbs in is where my question is. I noticed on there, it mentioned like oatmeal. My question is, can I add other things like sweet potatoes, bananas? What other carbs do you feel that I can add into that?
Really, any carbs are fine to add in. It's kind of whatever she'll eat because,
okay,
you know, you could add kaolin, but you can't get 20% of the calories in her diet from kale. She just won't eat that much. So the power of grains is the amount of calories and starch calories that they add to a diet without the dog having to eat a ton of them, because some dogs make it through pregnancy eating everything and others become unhappy with, you know, fruit, vegetables, things like that. So play with it, but just make sure you cook all the grains. And if you're going to do rice, do white sticky rice, cook it within an inch of its life, because you're not really trying to get micronutrients out of it. You're trying to get those carbohydrate molecules out of it. And so make sure it's digestible, easily digested. If you feed her something and you see it coming out the same way it went in, you know, feed her something else. She's not digesting
it.
The one thing I'll say, and maybe I love My Pet Carnivore, but I have not followed it recently, because when I moved to North Carolina, I had been feeding a food in New York that was no longer available down here. And I looked at My Pet Carnivore, and the problem that I had with it is that they did not do a guaranteed analysis on their foods. And I think that's fine for the vast majority of young adult, and senior dogs. It concerns me for puppies and bitches, both bitches that are lactating and bitches that are pregnant. And it's such a nice food. It really just annoyed the heck out of me that they would not submit their food to a lab for testing. So go look at the package or their website, or give them a call and see if they can tell you the calcium phosphorus ratio, because that and the lack of carbohydrates are the issue with a lot of raw diets, and why almost every theriogenologist tells you you should not feed raw, because it has too much calcium, not enough phosphorus most of the time. Or there are raws that are too much phosphorus because they're primarily muscle meat and they don't have, you know, because it's hard to do ground beef bones and things like that. So they don't have the calcium. So give them a call, check your packages, put it into the feeding calculator in A to Z and see if you can pin them down a little bit more on what's in their foods. And I really am speaking out of turn, because this was not 4 years ago. that I was looking at it, and they may well have submitted all of their food by now.
Okay. If for some reason they have not, I still want to feed raw, what then is the recommendation?
Yeah. So I have raised every litter since 2001 on raw, all but I think one pregnant bitch, and it was just because she was co-owned with a kibble feeder. So I'm there with you, and I agree, at least in my dogs, there are benefits. I'm a great believer that we feed the dog in front of us, not a theory, but I feed Canine Craving now, which is K-9, K-R-A-V-I-N-G, singular. But I mix with it, or I rotate foods with Primal, Stella and Chewy's. The problem with those two for Golden Retrievers is they're expensive foods. And yes. So Canine Craving, you can usually buy in bulk and is less expensive. What else? Aunt Jenny's, Steve's, Barf, post one into the Facebook group and we'll take a look at it. Because one of the things about raw is the transportation is so difficult since it has to be kept frozen. And so often your regional raws, it's one of the great things about My Pet Carnivore is you can get it anywhere. But your regional food manufacturers are going to be better, but you have to make sure that they do that guaranteed analysis. And some of them just won't do it. So, and it's, I think when they don't do it, it's a lot less risky for a non-breeding dog than it is for a breeding dog.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Good luck, Darla. Let us know.
Thank you.
Okay. Got Darla. Kelly. I see Kelly's question about mastitis and prophylactic use of antibiotics. Kelly, can you unmute?
Hello.
Hey there. How are you?
Hi. I'm great. Thanks. So I have a girl who is due in 2 weeks. This is her second litter. Her first whelp went fine, but about day 20, she developed mastitis. Before we knew she had it, she crashed with a fever of 106. I mean, it was just scary, awful, ruptured. It was a horrible experience for all of us. So she has healed. I don't have any idea what that mammary gland is going to, whether it's going to be productive, whether we're going to get milk or not, but it looks okay right now. So my question is, because we don't ever want to go through anything like that again, what information or advice can you give me regarding starting Clavamox when she whelps early on? I'm at a loss because my regular veterinarian is for it. He's the one who saw her in an emergent situation. My reproductive specialist is not. And I respect everyone's opinions, but I'd really like to do what's best for both mom and puppies.
Yeah. Those kind of mastitis cases are just so frightening. And your dog is so sick. It's kind of hard to believe how rapidly that infection can happen. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad she made it through it and I'm glad you guys survived, but I know it's really difficult. The first thing that I'll tell you is I would highly recommend you start the sunflower lecithin granules or powder the day the puppies are born, the day after. There's no benefit to doing it prior to, but start it as soon as the puppies are on the ground and she's eating, you know, whenever that is. If it's a day or two, that's fine. So lecithin reduces the solidity of the milk and it makes it less likely to end up with clogged ducts, and clogged ducts will often start the problem with mastitis. So that's number one. That's a good preventative no matter what else.
Can you spell that, please?
I'll put it in the chat. Will that be helpful? Sunflower lecithin powder. And I'm emphasizing powder. or dry form because the liquid is not as effective. And a lot of people go and get the drops. You want to get the powder. It comes in powder, it comes in granules. Easy to get on Amazon. It's really inexpensive. Most dogs could not care less about it. I've actually never heard of a dog that won't eat because it's in their food. There's lots of other things they don't want us to give them, but that's not an issue.
This as soon as the puppies are first meal that she has, or she's able to get in after puppies are born.
Exactly. You know, it doesn't, not during whelp or something like that, but as soon as she's sort of settled and back to eating again. How big is she?
She's 50 pounds, you know, 50, 55 pounds now. She's about 50 pounds average.
Okay. So she's putting 1 teaspoon of lecithin for every 20 pounds twice a day. So I just put that in the chat as well. That's the dosing. You with a 50, 55 pound dog can give a heaping tablespoon twice a day in each meal. It's not one of those products that we need to dose super carefully. This just gives us a ballpark. So, you know, you'll be right around a tablespoon twice a day.
Okay.
That's number one. Number two, keep those puppies' toenails trimmed. Ideally, every 3 days, you're trimming toenails, because as soon as we get scratches on the mammary glands, now there's an opening for bacteria. And we know there's bacteria in the whelping box, there's bacteria in her vagina, you know, there's poop, she's eating it. And so there is nothing particularly clean about a whelping box, except for we're trying to disinfect. But the more we can keep her skin whole, the better off you're going to be. And I am not in any way saying that caused the problem, but just going through how we should think about managing or preventing mastitis. Three, don't clean her mammary glands with anything but warm water. So for a while there, I was really close to folks at the CNI, and they had some mastitis and were trying to figure out what to do. So they started applying Bag Balm. Is everybody familiar with Bag Balm in the little green can? They use it with dairy cattle. Bag Balm on their bitches, and their mastitis rate went out the roof. So naturally there is this resistance in the skin of mammary glands that we mess up, because a lot of people start scrubbing mammary glands down, things like that, because they're so worried about mastitis. So clean box, but don't clean it. Now to your question, and I'm not avoiding it. I just wanted to give all the other preventive things we can do.
I understand.
So Clavamox is often effective on mastitis, not always. And so one of the issues with selecting a antibiotic now is you don't actually know if it will be effective against that specific bacteria that may find its way in. So a couple of other issues. Every time we give the bitch antibiotics, we are diminishing the puppy's microbiomes. We are negatively affecting the puppy's microbiome. So puppies are born with no microbiome. In utero, unlike human beings, there's this very, very small amount of bacteria that are given to puppies. During the birth process is when they start getting their microbiome, hence why puppies that are born vaginally have different microbiome than puppies that are born via C-section. The more normal are the ones that are born vaginal. And then through the environment over the first 3 days about is when they acquire their microbiome. And then it continues to mature well into puppyhood. So when we give the bitch antibiotics, we are killing her microbiome, but we're also killing the puppy's microbiome. Hmm. When we do that during pregnancy, we have evidence that it increases obesity in adulthood in puppies. It increases some of the allergies that they can have, environmental allergies that they can have as they grow up. We know less about giving it during nursing. We just know that it diminishes their microbiome. So what happens when we diminish a puppy's microbiome? Now it becomes susceptible to other infections. And now we have a puppy that really, it doesn't have much of an immune system to start with. It got a little bit of immunity from its mom from colostrum to some of the local pathogens. But we've taken away that basic bacterial microbiome to assist it in, you know, things that ingest. Mostly it's going to be ingestion that is the route of infection, or through the umbilical cord. So there is your balance, and probably why your repro vet is concerned about giving her antibiotics prophylactically. My recommendation, if she were mine, I'll tell you, if she were mine, what I would do is I would have those antibiotics on hand. I would not give them prophylactically, but I would have them on hand. So there's no emergency trip. They are sitting in my cupboard. I'm going to monitor her temperature like a hawk. And in an attempt to get ahead of it, if it happens again. Now, I haven't seen a trend. Like if a bitch has mastitis in one litter, is she going to have it in another litter? And I just haven't seen that over through Avidog or over my experience. Can it happen? Sure. But is it the most likely thing? I don't think so. So you may escape it, you may not. But that, as you think about your decision, though, that's something to think about. And yeah, I knew Kimberly and Jennifer just put in, we were just talking about this in Avidog, that Rita Rice had been taught, Rita's a borzoi breeder for many, many, many years. And she was taught to add a pinch of baking soda to the dog's water. And Kimberly may have pulled it up. Pinch of baking soda in the dam's food or water. Jennifer's been doing water. Most studies are in cows. Yep. And there is research in cows that baking soda can significantly reduce the risk of mastitis. And this is baking soda that the dog either eats or drinks. Small amount, pinch. That's like a 16th of a teaspoon. So that may be something. I haven't added that into Avidog. I need to get that into A to Z. But that may be something that you want to do, sort of do the full court press on prevention, have the antibiotics on hand if you're going to need them. And then hopefully you will not.
So the baking soda, adding a pinch just once a day into the water or every time you change up?
No, it was just once a day. And Kimberly does it in food. Jennifer does it in water. I think in dairy cattle, they're doing it primarily in food.
And my other question about the antibiotics is I do have the Clavamox on hand. Should I also have Baytril on hand? And then just if, you know, I mean, because I know it, one might be effective, the other might be effective, you don't know. So yeah,
Now, Baytril is a really powerful drug. So we have to be respectful if vets say that they're uncomfortable giving it to us. Sure. I usually say the negotiation I've made with my vets in the past is I won't use it until I talk to you, but I won't make you come in at 3 a.m. if I can call you and say, I want to put her on Baytril.
Absolutely.
Certainly having those two on hand really covers the vast majority of issues you're going to have of pathogens that are going to cause it.
Right. Thank you so much. Great information.
Yeah. Good luck, Kelly. Let us know how it goes. 2 weeks.
Thank you.
I need to see golden puppies. Okay. Kimberly, I see your hand up, so I'm going to. Hey there. Can you unmute?
There we go. Unmute.
Hey.
So I added the comments in the chat box as well, because it is a sad, sad saga of my 4th of July that ended up with 1 out of 6.
1 survived out of 6?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's taken me a lot to talk about it. So it started April 27th with progesterone of 0.2. We went all the way up to the first AI, which was on 5.5. Progesterone was 20. Second AI was on the 6th. I did vaginal cytology and came up with diestrus on May 9th. So that would put the whelping date at July 4th, which scared the heck out of me. It was a Sunday, and the celebrated holiday was the 5th, so I knew I was going to be stranded. We did an ultrasound at day 30, and we saw small sacs, but there were no embryos inside. So it kind of made the vet think perhaps maybe we were early in doing the ultrasound. So that gave me a little bit of hope, thinking perhaps my vaginal cytology is wrong, and we wouldn't have a 4th of July litter.
Barely.
Well, that wasn't the case. We did an x-ray. Well, first of all, the temperature dropped to 99.2 on the 1st of July, which was the lowest her temperature ever got.
Ever went.
I never got anything lower than that.
Yeah.
On the 2nd of July, we had the x-ray set up just to confirm, you know, what we were dealing with number wise, et cetera, because again, I knew I was going to be stranded. And we came up with 6 puppies, skulls and spines, perfectly formed. There was one a little bit bigger than the others, but nothing that really concerned either of us. On July 3rd, her water broke, but she was having no visible contractions. I was doing some manipulation. I wasn't really feeling any puppies present, et cetera. 4th of July at 3:30 in the morning, she stood up, circled 3 times, and passed a dead puppy. Lots and lots of green. So following my whelping rules, I started calling around to see where I could take her. First emergency room closest, didn't have a surgeon, wouldn't have a surgeon. I am of no assistance to you. Second emergency room, about 40 minutes away. We don't have a surgeon in right now. We can get one in. However, we will only do a C-section and spay if the puppy is halfway out. Well, if the puppy's halfway out, I can get the puppy the rest of the way out. You are of no assistance to me. Thank you very much. Third emergency room, about an hour and a half away. In the meantime, she stood up, circled 3 times, passed out another dead puppy. Still trying to find an emergency room that'll help me. Called one that's an hour and a half away, and they had a 4-hour wait.
God.
Okay. Still no assistance to me. She stands up, circles another time, and third dead puppy. So I'm thinking there was something perhaps in that one uterine horn that caused those puppies to go. Puppy number 4, here she is. Yay. The smallest little girl, she came out.
Almighty.
And then we had a stuck puppy. And I mean, stuck. I couldn't get it out. Wheelbarrow, I mean, KY jelly up behind it, manual manipulation, woods maneuver, nothing was getting this puppy out. Finally called an emergency room that was 2 hours away, and they said, yes, bring her in. Still hearing a fetal heartbeat on puppy number 6, but the stuck puppy is deceased. So now it's an emergency. So we run her down 2 hours. It didn't take that long, by the way. And they couldn't manually remove the puppy, so went in for a C-section. The puppy had its head in the vaginal canal, front part of the puppy in the left uterine horn, and the remainder of the puppy in the right horn. There was no way that puppy was coming out. And puppy number 6 died because of anesthesia, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Time, all of that good
time,
stuff.
Time, yeah.
So that's the disaster, but the happy ending. She's perfect. and my question is, do we take time off and not breed her this next cycle? Do we rebreed her? Oh, by the way, I had another litter due a week later. So I had to take one of the deceased puppies and do a necropsy myself to see if it was herpes. Yep. Thankfully, it was not. But yeah, that was bachelor's degree in biology. Many years on a farm. Horrible, cutting horrible moment. Open. But yes, at least I knew it wasn't herpes. The mom developed a fever after the surgery. We had to go back on the holiday, which was the 5th of July, to get an ultrasound and, you know, confirm there's no pyo, there's no reason for the fever, except perhaps the deceased puppies, and changed her over to Clavamox, and she responded. Wasn't a great mom.
Well, gosh, after all can't that, blame I don't her, frankly. Yeah, exactly. The heck with these guys. I don't want to have anything to do with them. Rebreeding. The rebreeding, regardless of what happened, the rebreeding, in my opinion, obviously talk to your vets, would be based on how she has recovered. Is she back in weight? Is she feeling healthy? Is she good to go? And frankly, how are you feeling? Because when we go through things like that, it's traumatic, and we need to care for ourselves in this too. We don't necessarily have to sign up for the anticipation of trauma again. So, you know, those two things should sort of be the parameters for rebreeding. Now, presumably, you have seen her discharge cleared up. She doesn't have SIP. She's not seeing ongoing bleeding. So her uterus has healed from the trauma. My guess, and this is purely a guess, is that one of those puppies was septic. And that's the exact same thing that happened to our litter. We did the necropsy to see what the pathogen was, and it was a very common bacteria that somehow killed one puppy, then three puppies, then four puppies.
We did a necropsy, negative.
No bacteria?
No bacteria.
It even aseptic issues like that, as a puppy dies and sort of begins to cause problems in the horns, it can kill other puppies. So your little girl right there was probably far away and very lucky. On managing the rebreeding, given that experience, and you know how rarely I say this, but get diestrous, look at your whelping window, and do a C-section early if it looks like you're hitting a weekend again. Yeah. Because we are, so many of us today are struggling with vet care that is fast enough to save our puppies. Yeah. It's just this huge issue. It's the issue I had. I mean, I had to drive to another state and go for 8 hours in order to get my pups out. So I totally, totally understand that experience and that issue. Now, what I'm doing is, I'll tell you how I'm handling it. Next breeding, I am moving to the town with my repro vet, who will do a C-section 24/7. Nice. She's fabulous. And I'm moving there for 3 weeks so that I get before whelping, and I stabilize the bitch and puppies before I pack up and bring them home. That's how my husband and I, because we said, we're never going through that again. Nope. It was way too traumatic.
Fortunately, the Sheltie litter was exactly 7 days later. The bitch dropped her temperature at noon, started to nest, et cetera, at 8 o'clock, contractions at 9, 7 puppies from a 7-year-old bitch. I did the AI myself, no progesterone testing, and she had 7 in 5 hours, and they're all perfect. So this one got to spend a lot of time with those puppies, and perfect. I tried something to bring some of those puppies over to her mom and see if she would nurse. She was nursing the Sheltie puppies and growling and snarling at her.
You're the one that caused me all this problem. You and your brother and sister.
You know, is it just me, or is that, I mean, that's exactly what I thought. I'm like, oh my God, this puppy is, you know, blind and can't hear you. So you're snarling at her means nothing, A. And B, you're allowing the Sheltie puppies to nurse. So there's nothing physically wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with your mothering ability. It's just, you don't want your own puppy.
You don't like your kid. Sometimes there's just no accounting for dogs, and we just have to accept they are dogs, and we will probably never explain behaviors like that. But I think so let me hit the high points of what you did really well. So you got diestrous.
Yep.
Really, really, really important, because that gave you, okay, I know what's coming now. I know when this is going to happen. Great job. You were able to check heartbeats. And so it wasn't for lack of effort on your part or lack of awareness of what was happening with the puppies. It was just they weren't coming out normally. So keep doing those things. Given I just had this conversation with Kelly about not starting prophylactic antibiotics, and you've heard me rant about prophylactic antibiotics, but it would be worth a conversation with your vet about, is this a time, or is it, we only do it because we're afraid, you know? And a lot of times I think we do antibiotics just because we're afraid. They actually aren't doing anything for us or really a benefit to anyone, because it's an issue when we give antibiotics during pregnancy to bitches. But those would be the two things. Third thing. So scheduled C-section. If you're not going to schedule the C-section, do your work ahead of time to find an ER. And I know how difficult that is, but I think it's so frightening to be doing it in the middle of a crisis and be getting going nowhere, that I would say, do your best to find one. We've got the list in A to Z about questions to ask an ER, and you can do it during the day when they aren't in crisis. You can pick a quiet time for them so that you can actually have a conversation, as opposed to, you know, midnight and they're in a rush and a car accident came in. And so those would be my recommendations.
The good news is I was able to ask the vet that did the C-section to take a picture of the uterus for me to see if there was any obvious sign of disease in the uterus, any clue as to why those puppies would have perished. And the uterus was perfect. There were no cysts. There was no disease. It actually was a pretty interesting picture to see the stuck puppy, because I've never seen that before in my breeding years. And I'm thinking primary inertia for those first three puppies, or they were already past their time and it was only these three that were producing the hormones to start the contractions. That's my only explanation for the first three being dead.
Well, it could be that you were at the end of the whelping window, the placentas were going, not gone yet, you know, because it's not like a light switch. They go quickly, but they don't all go at once. But what we also don't know is if one of those puppies was stuck and it just wasn't apparent, because typically from the outside, it's extremely difficult to tell that, especially if it's the first puppy, because they just don't ever really start contracting. And so we think we're still in stage one, when in reality, we're in stage two, but the uterus realizes, I better not push because this isn't going well. As things begin to back up, those puppies begin to die.
A bitch and a border collie, which they're very, very stoic. I mean, she just laid there. She just laid there. She wasn't distressed. She wasn't showing any signs of stress at all.
Why we use the whelping rules, and you did use them. It wasn't successful except for this one, but it's why we use the whelping rules, because the bitches can just sit there and rupture their uterus and we see nothing. There are no external signs. What they are not screaming, they are not crying, they are doing nothing. So, Kimberly, I'm going to jump to somebody else. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And good luck. Let us know how it goes.
Thanks.
Juliet, I see your hand up. Then Aaron, I'm going to pop to you in a sec. So be patient.
Hi, Juliet. Hello.
Hey there. How are you?
Good. Doing great.
Had a baby.
Cutest puppies. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I agree.
So a couple questions. My little girl has runny eyes, and I'm using Vetresin on her. But I'm just wondering if that's something to worry about, if I should get her in before her official eye exam.
How old?
And then, oh, go ahead.
How old is she?
6 weeks as of Monday, this past Monday.
And
the eye exam is at 8 weeks and 2 days.
Are the eyes red?
No.
Just and the like clear runny. It's not white, you know, it's not like pus.
No, it's just clear runny.
So, you know, it's never wrong to take them in. So I would never dissuade you from doing that. But, you know, so in examples of issues that can cause that in large breed puppies are that as the head develops, sometimes the eyelids will roll in and we end up with entropion, even though they're not going to have entropion, but the eyelid is rolled in. So that and dystichia, so those extra eyelashes, did you watch the eye webinar yesterday?
Were you able to watch the video? No, I did not.
So it's on the Good Breeders Center Facebook page and it's available. You might want to go in. So she, at the beginning, she talks a lot about structures of the eye and things like that and how to do an exam, but probably 3/4 of the way through, you might want to fast forward. She's got pictures of dystichia. Okay. And that's, let me see if I can.
I did look that up on the internet and was looking. So I understand that it's the eyelash growing under. So
it sort of grows. It you know, so normally eyelashes curve out. And these are eyelashes that just sort of lay on the eye. Super common, typically not a problem, but especially because eyelashes fall out. You know, it's not like it's there forever. And it well could be developmental. So what I would recommend if you can is have somebody else hold her in. You're going to take a pen light or some small flashlight. Don't make it too big or it'll really bother her. And you're going to look really carefully at her eyelid. And you're going to look, do I see, because dystichia are visible if we can look closely enough. You know, you don't need a magnifying glass or anything like that to see them. And entropion, you can see where the top of the eye, you know, so the eyelid itself doesn't have any hair on it. But if the part that lays against the eye usually, but if you're seeing a curve, and that absolutely can be a skull development issue, that the head just hasn't grown, the skin has outgrown the head. So those would be two things that I would look at now. Puppies can also just their tear ducts develop as well. And sometimes their tear ducts get blocked. Sometimes their tear ducts just haven't developed enough. In some Goldens, they literally don't have one of the tear ducts or it has a covering over it. And they just take this little plastic thing when they're 8 weeks old and go, and they pop it out. The eye doctor does. You're not going to be doing that.
Yeah.
So before I took her in, I would look closely at those things. If you see any redness, if you see any pus, if you see anything else, take her in. And if it gets worse, take her in. But if you look at it and you see an eyelash, you know, a dystichia or something, then just pull the eyelid down and see if you can pop that hair out.
Okay.
Usually there's like one or two. In bad cases, there can be more, but it's really rare. Usually it's just a couple. And so you can pull them out or you can just try and roll the eye so the hair moves away from the eye. Is that helpful?
Yes, very helpful. Yes, thank you.
Good. But don't hesitate to take her in if you're just not sure if it's
bad
or not.
Yeah.
You don't want eye scratched or you don't want an infection.
Right. Okay. Also the nursing. So Gypsy has been sore in her back. So we're kind of rotating the puppies now, three at a time. And kind of like giving her less food to maybe help that. I don't know. I don't know what I should be doing as far as helping her. Like we're supposed to go on an adventure walk this afternoon, and all the puppies are going to go after her again. So do I put a t-shirt on her?
Yeah. Although, man, they're good at getting through t-shirts, I have to say.
Okay.
You don't have a surgical suit?
No.
Yeah. Those are great to have on hand, and they're not very expensive. It just for future, not helpful today, but for future. I would definitely try and find a chiropractor if you can. I saw that you're taking her into the massage therapist. Does the massage therapist do chiropractic?
She will help me get into a chiropractor. She knows a chiropractor. So if that is what she needs, that's where we'll go. She just is someone that I really trust and has worked on my dogs for a long time.
Yeah. So that I think would be high on the list. She probably during whelping or something threw something out, and now she has all these puppies dragging on her, and they're heavy. You know, they outweigh her by a fair amount.
Oh yeah, they're all 7.25 pounds plus.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
there's nine of them.
So, where you're taking her on the adventure walk, can you take her off leash?
Oh yeah.
And so I would definitely take her off leash because, I mean, you might start with her on leash, and then as soon as you sort of have momentum, get her off leash if she's under good voice control so that she can get away from them. If you keep her on leash, you're sort of forcing her. Now, is she so sore that you wouldn't want her running?
No, she seems a lot better today.
Okay.
Yeah, since we've been limiting the weight on her, she seems a lot better today. She's going up and down the stairs. She's playing with her ball. So I think she could definitely handle, I think she's bored too. So I think she could handle some of that as well.
Yeah, so put them on leash to move them, to get them started. And then, you know, hopefully it's not very far. Take her off leash. They'll chase her. But do you have a couple people going with you so you can round them up?
Or you by yourself?
You by yourself?
Yeah, I do have two people that are going to be there, but they're older, and so I don't think they'll be running after puppies. But
well, if they can at least keep some of them, the way I usually do it if I'm by myself on a woods walk is I take a collar and leash. If I need to go round up puppies, I tie the bitch. You probably don't want to do this with Gypsy, but tie the bitch to a tree so that the puppies stay with her, and then I go and find, you know, whoever got themselves misplaced. Okay. So the puppies will probably stay with your friends, and then you can go and do the finding if there's somebody who got themselves in a...
Oh, perfect. Okay. Okay. Yeah, it's a safe property. So it's all fenced, you know, along the roadway kind of thing. So they'll be safe.
Sounds like fun. I hope she's feeling better.
Yeah, she is. I was happy to see her smiling and wanting to play with her ball. That was a good sign. So
I would not do a lot of ball playing, unfortunately, but maybe that adventure walk will help.
Yes. Yeah. No balls right now. No.
Yeah. No. Terrific. Well, have fun this afternoon.
Thanks so much. I appreciate your help.
Thanks, Juliet.
All right.
Erin, I'm going to go to you next, but are you there? Can you unmute?
Hi, Gail. Yeah, I have my question in the comments, so I don't really have anything to add to it. I just didn't know if you or anybody on the call had experienced swimmer's puppies. I have not personally, but she experienced this about a week ago. The puppy has passed, but just for future, better to be prepared.
Yeah, so Pectus excavatum is different than most swimmers, and it is a congenital issue in puppies. Very guarded prognosis with puppies that have this. So this is when their sternum and chest actually go in. They're typically born that way or develops very soon after birth. It's extremely difficult to keep those guys alive. It's possible, but it's really, really difficult. We've had a few in Avidog and I think one made it. So different than swimmers. So swimmers are normal puppies typically who, because of however either the traction that they had or how heavy they were, which it can certainly happen in small litters, they can't get their legs underneath them. Their legs go out to the side, front legs and rear legs tend to go out to the side. And because their bones are so malleable and they are lying on their chests as opposed to with their four legs underneath them, pressing on their mom or the way puppies normally interact, lying on their side, all of those things are normal. But this, when the puppy's legs are out and the bones are soft, the chest begins to flatten. And as the chest begins to flatten, now they can't get their legs underneath them because of what's happening with the bones. And those bones are normal, naturally soft. And so it's not unusual for that to happen. So when you see a swimmer puppy, it's really important to act as soon as you think, gosh, that puppy appears to have a flat chest. Because you can change the bones as well. You know, they're soft and you can manipulate them. So number one thing to do, and I think the thing that has the biggest effect, that we have seen the biggest effect over the years, is improve the traction immediately for the litter. So you may think you have good traction, but you would likely do not have good traction. It is critical that puppies don't slip, even from the very, very beginning. So you're going to improve the traction. Then you're going to go get that egg crate foam. You know, you can buy like mattress toppers and egg crate foam, and you are going to put that underneath the bedding. So now the puppies are not on a hard, flat surface. Now they have egg crate foam underneath it, and it's more difficult for them. Then you are going to hobble your puppies. And it sounds terrible. And the first time you do it, you're going to be thinking, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm doing this. And when you hobble, you tie the two front legs together, it can be between the elbows and the pastern in the wrist. And then you're going to tie the hind legs together. So the puppy's legs are tied underneath it. You are going to, and I can put into the Facebook pages, Facebook groups, what those hobbles look like. You're going to lie those puppies on the side, you know, so those puppies usually end up on their chest and the legs are going out to the side and now they can't get onto their side. So you are going to start laying them on their side all the time, over and over and over. You're going to lie them on their side. You can move their legs, you can do a little physical therapy, but most importantly is good traction and hobbling. Some puppies only need hobbles for a day. And what's kind of remarkable is, say you catch it, this is typically something you're going to see at 3 weeks, maybe 2.5 to 3 weeks, where they're just starting to toddle. And you put the hobbles on and a day later, they're up walking around. Actually, you put the hobbles on and they get up and walk around with the hobbles on. And it feels like I'm making it so they can't walk. And in reality, you're making it so that they can walk, and they start to walk and they start to run. And as they use their legs, now their body reshapes itself. So if we catch swimmers early, the vast majority of swimmers have a very good prognosis, different than pectus excavatum, where they do not have a good prognosis. So really important, I think, that those are the kinds of photos that are really important to post in breeder groups, because there are many vets who will go their entire lives and never see these issues in a puppy. And what you want is a lot of experienced eyes looking at your puppy, videotape your puppy and photograph your puppy and put it up so that we can all look at it and say, oh yeah, that's a swimmer, or no, that's just a really fat puppy and you need to improve your traction. Okay, I am going to jump to, how are we doing on time? 15 minutes. Mickey, I'm gonna jump to you if you're there. You are.
Thank you so much. Hi.
Hey.
Hi. I have two questions. The first question is, I have a bitch that should have been coming into heat right now, and she doesn't seem to be progressing at all. I got that strong thing from
Be Strong.
And I read somewhere about, I think it was wheat germ oil or something like that. So I was wondering about suggestions about that. And then my second, if it's okay, I go to the second question. I helped somebody deliver a litter. We expected six. We had six beautiful babies, everything textbook. The seventh, I didn't expect. I didn't have a Doppler with me. I didn't expect it, but she was pushing, so I knew something was happening. That one came out perfectly formed, beautiful, pink tongue, dead. She stillborn. I tried everything I can think of with the needle beneath the nose and mouth to mouth and chest compressions, et cetera. And then she continued to push again, not that hard, but pushing a little. And after a while, that one came out exactly like the seventh one did. And I don't know, you know, you always hit yourself in the behind, like, what should I have done? What didn't I do? So that those are my two questions. Any suggests to help me with the next one?
Yeah, so let's start with getting your bitch to come in season. How long has it been since her last heat?
6 months. So it's 6 months.
She's still normal. She's just going to drag it out. Yeah, I mean, we have to remember that 8 to 9 months is perfectly normal. 10 and 11 months is also normal. And there is as much variation over a bitch's lifetime in heat cycles as there are between bitches. So it isn't unusual for a bitch to have been 6 months like clockwork for three heats and then suddenly go haywire and now she's 11 months. It's particularly true if you really need to breed her. That's, you know, the national is coming up, you're the stud, whatever, you know, they're bitches. So Susan Patterson has had success and does, and, you know, she runs the Canine Fertility Group as well as being a good dog breeder expert. She recommends Be Strong and the wheat germ oil. And I think she posted the other day a study or some evidence about the wheat germ oil.
Yeah.
So I don't have the dosing on that. Did you see that? Do you know?
I did take a look at it, but I didn't look at dosing, but I saw it.
Yeah. So I'll try and find, you know, let me find my notepad. I'll try and find the dosing on the wheat germ oil. It ended up hurt her and might help. What else can you do? Find another bitch in season and move them in together for a day or two. Usually it doesn't take a long time, but it really is, that is incredibly helpful. And then if you're really desperate, you can use cabergoline or PG600 to trigger a cycle. Both of those are pretty effective. Cabergoline's by prescription. PG600 is over the counter. You can get it through Revival. And cabergoline is a product that's put in her food, does not have many side effects. PG600 is a series of two injections. They can be painful, sort of acutely in the immediate term as it's given. But Celeste has used it. I don't know if Celeste is still on. Celeste has used PG600, and she and her vet figured out that putting it in the refrigerator, cooling it, diminishes any impact on the bitch at all. Hutch recommends cabergoline. He doesn't recommend PG600, but I think it's just because there aren't a whole lot of studies on it. But lots of Avidog people have used it successfully. So Be Strong, wheat germ, find a bitch in season, cabergoline, PG600. But I wouldn't waste your money on either PG600 or cabergoline for another month or two, unless for some reason you really need the litter, you need to time the litter now. Okay.
Fine.
Stillborn puppies. So the experience is not at all unusual. And I have a report. I don't know if anybody can grab it off of the Breeder College and stick it into the chat, but I wrote a report last year, really good study on stillborn puppies. I think they looked at something like 1,300 litters or puppies. It was a huge sample. And they found, you know, stillborn puppies are really common. The puppies later in a litter, last puppy in a litter has this huge chance of being stillborn. And they sort of look at first litter, first puppy, second puppy, they go through size of litter as well as age of dam, and then where the puppy is in the birth order. They also look at whether calcium was given and whether oxytocin was given. Above all, I walked away from that study saying, I want to use oxy as little as possible. Calcium was so much more effective. The other thing that they found that completely changed my way of thinking is that really the optimal time between puppies is no more than 55 to 60 minutes. It used to be, we would say 2 hours. And they looked at from 60 minutes to 120 and looked at how many puppies die in that length of time. So speed, I mean, being at the end is a bad position. It just being at the end of a litter, not good. What can we do? We can try and move things along more quickly than I've recommended in the past. So that is going to be large amounts of oral calcium. Oral calcium makes those contractions stronger. And, you know, the bitch is at the 7th or 8th puppy, her uterus, she's tired, her uterus is tired, the contractions are weaker. And so we want to give them that boost to try and get those contractions going. We also want to start taking action at the 45 minute mark, at the 40 minute mark, rather than at the 90 minute mark. So what can we do? Go for a walk, go for a car ride, even if you're just driving around the driveway, wheelbarrow, woods maneuver, and sort of repeat those actively until that puppy comes out. So those, I think, are the findings that we've seen. And I know I've sped up that process a lot more quickly. I would usually be closer to, so if I had to leave at 90 minutes to head to the vet, I'd be thinking like maybe at 75 minutes, I would start to do woods maneuver and things like that. Now I'm doing them at 40 minutes.
I did, we gave her the calcium. I did walk her. I didn't drive her around, but I did walk her. And when she started breathing real hard, I gave her the calcium, but it wasn't, you know, and the thing of it is that since I read all of your stuff, which I love, you're wonderful. I advised her not to do an X-ray. So even though she looked bigger than 6 puppies to me, I figured 6. Matter of fact, the vet called us. She has a great deal with the vet. She pays a couple of $100 and they will be there for her on call if she needs them. So they called at the end of 6 and he said, well, looks like it's over, but I knew it wasn't because she was still pushing. But I just felt so bad because, you know, the people need the money and stuff like that, even in terms of 2, and they were perfect. Absolutely perfect.
It's heartbreaking. Yeah. Just, it's so heartbreaking. I think I can remember almost every stillborn puppy we've ever had because they are almost always perfect. And they look like if I could just breathe that spark of life into you, you would be perfectly normal because they died really recently. You know, part of it is we just have to expect that there is that risk of stillborn, especially towards the end of a litter. Mm-hmm. We also have to know that even if we X-ray, so I X-rayed 13 and had 15. And there was no 15 on that X-ray. Yeah. So I think letting our bitch tell us when she's done and a Doppler on hand is super helpful. Even if you just have a stethoscope on hand, a fetal stethoscope, you can tell the difference between the bitch's heartbeat and the puppy's heartbeat, and you can search to see if they are done. I don't find palpation particularly easy because the uterus is just so knotted and engorged right. at that point that it can feel like a puppy. But I think the Doppler or stethoscope would help. And it sounds like you did a lot. Which maneuver is definitely something to add or to make sure that you're comfortable doing, because it's kind of remarkable. You know, that's when you lie the bitch between your legs and her head is towards your feet, and you pick up her hind legs and, you know, gently stretch them so that you're changing the pelvis completely. That can loosen up puppies pretty quickly. It's probably not going to loosen up the one that Kimberly was talking about, but it may help. But at the same time, and then mega doses of calcium, like just so much more calcium than we think we should give, but it really can help. And then at some point, some of them are just going to die.
I thank you. Thank you so very much.
Good luck, Mickey. Let us know when your girl comes in.
I will. Thanks.
Molly, I think there you are. You're right next to me. Hi. There you go.
So it's been a while since I've been on, and I was writing this manuscript and then realized, oh, I should have just done a couple of keywords there and filled in. This is something that I want to turn around. Whatever is going on here, it continues to happen. And I'm trying to make sense of it.
Yeah, poor guy.
The other thing is the dams that are coming in are not in heat. They're not ready to whelp. I'm just watching them for a guardian family. So, you know, it's for like a week's time. And I'm being very careful about how they enter the home. I mean, I'm being really thoughtful about all that. These are puppies that actually were born here. The mom is still here. She's a mom and a grandmother. But I've had this now with three female adult dams that are going to be breeders. And I see this pattern of,
and it's always with Bruno.
It's always with Bruno. The only other dog here besides Bruno is Honey. They actually do a little bit of that with Honey. It's more play bow and trying to initiate that. And she just lets them know right away. Okay,
that's a bitch thing.
Yeah, I'll do it with you, or I'm not going to do it with you and knock it off. But he is so sweet and gentle, and they just go after him, and it gets worse. And I'm trying to think it through and experimenting, and he's never hurt when I have let them try to sort it out. He has never hurt them when he has finally stood up and, you know, woo, woo, you know. But
yeah, so there are just some dogs in the world that have a kick me sign on them. And, we don't know why. We can't look at the dog and say, you know, why is it that other dogs just pick on them? Don't know. But I do think that it sounds like you are trying to control the situation, maybe take a few more steps, because two reasons. One, we never want a dog practicing that bullying aggressive behavior. It's just not a good thing not a good behavior for them to practice. Two, it's not really fair to Bruno. It's his home.
Okay.
You know, it's his home. He lives there. He's trying to be a gentleman. He's being a good guy. And Honey is one of those dogs that can draw a line and communicate it and say, no, we're not doing that. I'm not playing with you, or I am playing with you, but I'm in charge. Bruno's not that guy. He can't do that. And we don't really want to wait until he figures it out. because, you know, it's just not fair to him. I'm a great believer that anytime we bring other dogs into our home, protecting our dogs is essential because it's their home. So it would be like somebody bringing a bully into your home and turning them loose and being like, hey, Molly, buck up.
Right.
You know, so we don't want to
think about what you have said before about trust. One of the most important things that we can do with our puppies that we're raising is to have their back, you know, that they know that we will step in. But at the same time, I'm thinking, what am I missing here? Am I
who he is? It may just be who he is.
Okay.
And so be it. So I would put adaptive collars on those bitches before they walk into that house. I would probably put adaptive collars on Bruno and Honey too, okay, when I'm bringing in another dog. Okay. So the whole place is a little more mellow. We're all a little more mellow than we normally are. And I would find a way to divide the house. So whether it's X pens, I would normally put the incoming bitches in X pens so that Bruno's not getting relegated to an X pen. Although some dogs would prefer that. Like, can right. I just have my little X pen space?
Yeah, right.
Exactly. But if that's not him, then we want to confine the other dogs because, especially if they're going to be rude bitches, they got to be comfortable being confined in your home anyway.
Right.
And so sort of that, hey, you know, when you come visit us, we love you. We're really happy to see you, but this is the role that you play. You are confined. You aren't allowed to be a jerk to Bruno. You better listen to Honey. Honey, it communicates that piece.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would do tethers, leashes, everything so that you can show those young dogs how they're supposed to behave. And that means you aren't charging Bruno. And you aren't even growling at Bruno. In fact, you don't even get to stare at Bruno. Like, you know, because staring is really rude. And I always draw the analogy, especially for those of you who are not New Yorkers, you're sitting on a New York subway and you realize that the guy across from you is staring at you. And just staring at you. And just keep staring at you. You'll start to get chills up and down your spine. It is the most disconcerting thing. Dogs do the same thing. And staring is as aggressive as somebody sitting on the subway staring at you for 5 minutes. And so we want to teach dogs they are not allowed, you know, because I taught thousands of puppies in puppy class. And I would be sitting there, big room, and suddenly a dog would go, wah, 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 wah. And we would correct the dog that exploded. But in reality, it was the puppy across the way that had been staring at him for 10 minutes that finally freaked this dog out enough that it exploded. So who should have been corrected in those situations?
One staring.
The starer. Mm-hmm. So you're going to teach those bitches no staring, no growling, no charging, Bruno. You are controlled. You are confined. I am in charge of how we interact. You can leave Honey to do her thing. That's great. It's always nice for a young dog to have somebody that they can interact with and understand the rules. Mm-hmm. But Bruno's just one of those guys who's going to get picked on, and we don't want him to get picked on.
No. Okay.
Is that helpful at all?
It is very helpful. Let me just add one other piece that we were not figuring out what to do with the most recent pup that was here. Not pup, she's a year old now.
She's a pup.
She would bark at Honey every morning to get this exchange. Let's wrestle, let's do it, come on. And if Honey would not do it, she would bark just constantly.
Play with me, yo.
Loud.
Play with me.
And we could not. I tried.
Put her in a crate. Put her in a crate.
I should have done that.
Yeah. So the way I do it, Molly, I'm really bad. I'm like, oh, honey. Not honey. I'm saying that.
Joy.
Like, oh, dear. You want to go in the crate? okay, in the crate, throw in a few cookies, cover the crate, be done with it. Like, because, you know, it would be my niece and her husband come to visit and their baby is screaming at me as I wake up in the morning and I'm really not feeling like playing it with him, but he's like, play with me, play with me, play with me. I'd be really annoyed. You know, it would just start the whole day wrong. So think about teaching these bitches proper behavior in a home with multiple dogs, in your home with multiple dogs. Mary, I see you. You're dying to leap in.
We've had a lot of dogs come in and out and sometimes bitches for servicing. And I've got a lot of bitches. And one of the things that I have learned is their first interaction is never in my home. Because if a girl walks into a home and she's not met these dogs before, she doesn't understand relationship or anything. And our dogs are relationship critters.
Right.
And so we always have introductions outside and they are controlled introductions where everybody's minding their manners, getting acquainted. And then we have a process where everyone sits and dogs are released one by one to come into the house. And the new dog comes in absolutely last. And we do, like what Gail was saying, we keep areas confined. The new dog isn't allowed certain places. And, you know, and then it really establishes that you are a guest here. You don't own the place. And it leaves then our dogs aren't feeling like, oh, I'm not going to get my bed at night or something like that. And it is, and we do have to be aware of them. And the boys are always the ones who get beat up if there's a problem because girls really run the show. But we really have found that if we do introductions outside and if we establish an order with when they come inside and the expectation is manners, then it just goes a lot easier. Because I had a bitch come in once and the first thing she did was jump up on my sofa and pee. And that was like, I mean, there was no stud fee that was high enough to cover that. I mean, okay. It was just, and so I had to just back up and really ascertain what I was doing in letting them just come in and have free reign when it's not their home. Wow. And it's not that I don't want them to feel bad. I just want them to know their place.
I think I got what you're both saying is so helpful. And I can go back through. I'm just kicking myself that I allowed that behavior to go on for almost a week, you know, so I'm going to have to undo that because
go apologize to Bruno, go cuddle.
Absolutely. But feeling confused too about like when I think about new dogs meeting Mary, that would have absolutely clicked to do it outside. And but I was thinking of it as these are puppies that I birthed here that you know were here for 8 weeks or what, you know, that's what I was thinking. Honey and Bruno.
Yeah. No. Yeah. So you want to think that they don't know each other. And there's a good discussion in puppy college about introducing dogs and parallel walking. And we're big fans of parallel, even if that walk is 3 minutes. 3 minutes. So read up on that and see if that helps and let us know how it helps. Thanks, Mary. That was good input.
So great. Thank you.
Good luck.
Poor Bruno.
Okay, guys. I've kept you too long. I'm sorry we didn't get to all the questions. Please, I will try and grab some of them and put them in the Facebook group, but you can absolutely post your question in the Facebook group. I did see there was a question on unilateral cryptorchidism. I have a report on that that sort of summarizes the research, and I will put that, it's already in the Avidog group. I will put that in the Good Dog group. So you can go ahead and read that and try and make sense of how you want to think about it. And then I will answer any questions that you have in the Facebook group. Thank you so much for those that joined you, Cheryl. I'm sorry I can't get to your question, but either send it to office hours or post it in the group. And I will take a look at everything else. It was wonderful to have the new people join us. It was really terrific. I hope you enjoyed yourself. And I will see you our next call. I'm looking for my little sheet. My cheat sheet is September 14th at 8 p.m. And I look forward to seeing you then. Bye, guys.